Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming today. So as Jessica said, I'm going to be discussing the association between human rights violations, depression, and hunger in Chin State, Burma. Before I get started, I'd just like to acknowledge the larger team that worked on this research. So we had a team composed of people from Johns Hopkins University, Chris Baer and Luke Mullaney, Adam Richards, who is a physician at UCLA, and Richard Solom, who is the director of research at Physicians for Human Rights. So Rick and I were the ones that actually went and conducted the study, and many of these slides are his, so I'll thank him for that. If you're interested in the larger study and the advocacy report, that's available at lifeunderthejunta.org, and I recommend that you take a look at that as well. So just to get started, I'll give a little bit of background about Burma. So as many of you know, Burma has been under about 5 decades of military rule, the State Peace and Development Council, and there have been ongoing civil wars with ethnic minorities, mainly along the borders. So many of you will be familiar with the ongoing conflict with the Karen and the Kachin and the Mon along the Thai-Burma border. There were elections in 2010, which were largely seen as sham elections by people that work inside Burma. A certain percentage of the seats for parliament actually had to go to the State Peace and Development Council, and many people there were many reports of people threatened, at the time of voting to vote a certain way and that sort of thing. So definitely a questionable election. In terms of Chin State, it is an isolated ethnic minority region along the India-Burma border of about 500,000 people, the total population, 1% of the entire nation. The majority of people in this country are ethnically Chin and they're Christian, which serves as another source of discrimination from the majority Burmese Buddhist government. And I should say that the Chin population, although the ethnicity is sort of labeled Chin for the entire state, we're talking about a tremendously varied group of people, 60 different tribes and 5 different languages. So the objective of this study was to determine the prevalence specifically of human rights violations and crimes against humanity in Chin State, Burma. So we actually did this study in order to inform, to determine whether or not a commission of inquiry should be called into crimes against humanity in Burma committed by the SPDC. We also looked to quantify household hunger, depression, and malnutrition in Chin State, Burma, and then determine the links between health status and human rights violations in the country. So, as I said again, this was a collaboration between epidemiologists at Physicians for Human Rights at Johns Hopkins University, the Global Health Access Program, which is an organization that's U.S.-based that provides technical assistance to community-based organizations in and around Burma, and then several Chin community-based organizations, including the Chin Human Rights Organization. Essentially, the study was done by recruiting 22 Chin surveyors who very bravely came across the border from Chin State into India for two-week training. They were trained on an 87-question survey, which went through household demographic data, access to health care, physical and mental health status, food insecurity, and human rights violations within the past 12 months. The human rights violations that we asked about included forced labor, pillaging, forced displacement, conscription of child soldiers, detention, disappearance, group persecution, murder, rape, and torture. Forced labor specifically generally entailed a military battalion coming through from village to village, forcibly recruiting 1 to 2 members of each household to work on military projects, including constructions of roads, bridges, and portering, often with, as you would imagine, little water and little food, and under threat of death. For each human rights violation, we collected data on the perpetrator, the timing, and the specifics of what happened, and actually collected why people thought it happened, which was an interesting set of data that I won't completely go into. Much of the reason we did that was just to ensure that these were actually human rights violations and not criminal activity. The study itself was a 3-stage, 90-by-8 cluster survey done inside Chin State between February and March of 2010. As you would imagine, the Burmese government was not forthcoming with maps and population data, so the sample frame was constructed using a combination of Department of Defense geographic coordinates and Oak Ridge land scan population estimates, and we were able to include all 991 villages that we identified in that way. The Oak Ridge land scan population data, is anybody familiar with that at all? It's really interesting. So what they do is, this has been used in Cyclone Nargis before, but they essentially use farmland, ambient light, they come up with an estimate of the population in a region within 24 hours, which is really interesting, just using satellite data. So the cluster sample included access to all 9 townships, and we stratified urban and rural towns and used probability proportional to size sampling. Obviously, a very rigorous consent process, not only for the people that were included access to all 9 townships and we respondents, but specifically for the surveyors themselves as well. Obviously, they were doing this at some risk to themselves. The health outcomes were measured in several ways. So specifically looking at household hunger, we used the household hunger scale, which was developed as a part of the FANTA II, the Food and Nutrition Technical Assistance Project, which was developed and validated by USAID in multiple settings. The questions asked specifically, in the past 30 days, have one or more of your household members gone to sleep hungry, passed an entire day without food, or had a complete lack of food? And the prevalence of moderate to severe hunger in Chin State is 42.6%. Almost half of the households reported it. In terms of screening for depression, ideally for depression you would want an interview with a seasoned mental health practitioner. For logistic reasons and security reasons that wasn't possible, so we used the patient health questionnaire, PHQ-2, which is a two-question screen for depression, which asks about interest in activities and sense of hopelessness. And that the prevalence of people that screened positive for depression was almost 39%. In terms of the human rights violations that were identified, they included most commonly forced labor. So 92% of all households in Chin State and Burma have been forced to undergo forced labor. Religious and ethnic persecution, 14%. Arbitrary arrest, 6%. Disappearance, 5%. Torture, 4%. Rape, 3%. And it's interesting, when you present these numbers, you know, 3% doesn't sound like a big number, but when you're talking about a population of 500,000 people, you're talking about 2,000 to 3,000 people, men and women, that have been raped within the last year in this state alone. Livestock stolen or killed, 53%, people forced to give money. So the military actually gets almost no support from the government. They're expected to essentially scavenge for their support, so they pillage the local villages, essentially. And the context that this is happening in is really interesting, because in every 50 years in this region, in India and in Chin State, there's a type of bamboo that flowers and leads to an explosion in the rat population locally. And these rats basically devour local crops. So it's called the rat famine. It happens every 50 years. So you're having this on top of a rat famine, which obviously has implications for how, in this study, human rights violations directly affect food security. So in terms of the relationship between human rights, hunger, and depression, there was a strong dose-response relationship between human rights violations, depression, and household hunger. So households experiencing 2 human rights violations within the last 12 months were 3 times more likely to suffer from household hunger. If it was 4 human rights violations, 4 times more likely. If it was 6, you're talking 6 times more likely to suffer from household hunger. So definite, strong, consistent relationship. Households reporting exposure to 4 and 6 human rights violations were 2 and 3 times more likely to report moderate to severe depression. And these were adjusted for rural residents, destruction of crops by the pests, by the rats, and for the other outcome, hunger and depression. So the implications of this study. We know from a lot of data globally that human rights violations are associated with depression and PTSD. So I think this is another supporting bit of evidence, kind of showing that relationship consistently. And there is some evidence to link food insecurity with depression. The likely mechanism is thought to be that hunger leads to a sense of anxiety over not being able to provide for your family or yourself, and that leads to depression. It's interesting, there's a little bit of evidence to show that potentially depression actually leads to some element of food insecurity as well, as people become less likely to provide for themselves, or less able, rather, to provide for themselves. That's mainly in the U.S. context. In this study specifically, there didn't appear to be a mediating effect of food insecurity or household hunger on depression. They seem to be sort of parallel, unrelated processes. But the bottom line is, given it doesn't, at least to my mind, doesn't particularly matter how they interact. The bottom line is, human rights violations, once again, we can see very consistently have a very direct effect on health. This is a public health problem. There's a very strong relationship between increasing human rights violations and the health of the population. And one of the practical ways in which this data could be used is the pairing of mental health programs and food aid programs, specifically in this context, but it's something to consider in other contexts as well. And then the last bullet point, that this link between human rights violations and food insecurity and mental health just needs more study. This is a picture of the India-Burma border. Chin State's on one side. You can't really see it. The other side over here not by the red buildings, the other side over there. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
Okay.
Yep, sure.
Thank you. Perfect slide to end on, because I do hope that we can have a bit of a discussion. So we heard a lot this morning, varied, but with consistent themes. Angela Maria spoke about the rule of law and how it has the strongest effect on life expectancy and infant mortality when compared to other indexes. Samer talked about the concept of human security and the seven dimensions that make it up and how it is not present in the literature but can also be taken advantage of and misused in negative ways. And then Parveen spoke about the role of human rights violations in Burma and its effect on health, specifically mental health. So I want to just open it up to conversation, dialogue, and questions from the audience. I think it's a small enough room. We may be able to not use the microphone, but if you're having trouble, let me know.
Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My name is Fabian. I'm an MPH student in Northwest. And my question would be for Parveen. I'm just learning a lot about research, and I wonder how, if you were asking or interviewing with a question, if you were interviewing the victims, how did you address the problem of re-traumatized?
It is such a good question. It's definitely a concern. So I've done this study, and I've done a couple of studies on sexual violence in Cameroon as well, which is definitely an issue in both studies. This is actually a part of the consent process generally for me. Ideally, when you're doing a study, what you want to do is have availability to mental health practitioners, particularly if you're asking questions, screening for depression, and someone screens positive and you get a sense they really need to help, that's what you would like to do. It's an interesting ethical question because we're asking about a problem we can't treat. My take on it is when you're in a place there's never going to be hope delivered unless you identify a problem. So you get the consent of the person that you're working with, you make it part of your consent process, and then you do your best to present it.
I would be interested if the team or you represent yourself by the people who might have violated their rights.
So the training actually happens in India across the border. But it's interesting. The Indian government locally was not really. This was done definitely without the Indian government necessarily knowing what exactly was happening for obvious reasons. We were threatened specifically, but you're absolutely right. It had to be done very carefully. It's again an interesting ethical dilemma because as a researcher from Harvard, I don't generally encounter personal security issues because I can usually get my way out of it by being an American citizen and being a researcher from Harvard. But when you're talking about surveyors that are young men and young women, they're the ones that are actually
along those lines, have you followed up with the surveys to make sure they're still safe after going around?
Yeah, they were fine. They actually, all of the surveyors were public health workers that came across the border regularly anyway.
Okay.
To sort of provide help aid. So they all knew exactly what they were doing. They were very safe about it.
Okay, good. You're right here.
Yeah, thank you all very much. I think this is such an important discussion. And I'm wondering, I think I've always felt sort of the struggle with, we invest so much money sometimes in, HIV treatment or, breastfeeding promotion or, some other programs. It's like, well, yeah, but the context is, if we could change the context, a lot of those problems could be resolved more. So I wonder your thoughts in terms of investment, where should the investment of time and energy go in relation to
the $30 million question. Where can the money go to change what you're discussing?
I don't think it's a matter of money. It seems to me that we started I God may propose that the issue of power, the distribution of power, is essentially the link that connects the three presentations. I mean, whether in relation to the rule of law or a violation of human rights or in the issue of the pervasive insecurity, all of this connects essentially to the to a key determinant of health, which is the distribution of powers, monetary and otherwise. And what's happening is that the problem is that with the global health efforts is that we frequently contribute to the maldistribution of powers rather than undermine them. I mean, with a lot of the international institutions, starting with the World Bank investing in health in the 1990s and so on, and now big big global players in global health, we do not necessarily change the power imbalances, but rather contribute in many ways to actually strengthening.
Mm-hmm. I will complement a little bit the answer with definitely power is very important, and I think education gets to the power balance. I've been working a lot on education and violence prevention as well, not only with the rule of law but with many other projects, and to me, if I have to invest money on something, I would say education.
I definitely echo the sentiment on education. It's interesting in the Burmese context, because we actually took this data to Geneva, and we talked to members of the Human Rights Council, you know, UNHCR, ICRC, we talked to many different actors in Geneva in advance of the UPR, the Periodic Review for Burma in 2010. And across the board, everyone's reaction is, gosh, this is awful. You know, this is terrible. How can this government get away with this? And then, you know, you get the political answer, which is, well, we're in the midst of reform, so let's just see what happens. So, you know, the thing that always strikes me is that the knowledge of the system, or sorry, rather the knowledge of the violations that are going on is not enough, that there has to be political will behind it. It's an interesting situation now in Burma. I think I'm sure many of you have heard what's going on in Rakhine State with the Rohingya, with entire villages being wiped out. Now, that's not a new situation. That has been that way since the 90s. You know, you've got Muslim minority living in Burma. They're stateless in Burma. They're stateless in Bangladesh. They're hated by both sides. As actually, when we did this study, we visited Cox's Bazaar and saw some of the camps there and wrote a separate report on that. You know, but everyone kind of, you know, while people are talking about it, the political will to act on it is limited because everybody wants to see where the Burmese reform is going to go. So the consequences just aren't there. So, yeah, I don't know that that's an answer. I think it's just sharing frustration more than anything else.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of, my knowledge about the Burmese situation is that most of the healthcare is actually happening either in Thailand or India, and people kind of come over the border for their healthcare and go back. Is there any structure that's happening in the state of healthcare, or
yeah.
Is it really just kind of non-existent?
Yeah, so well, some of the questions we asked in the study were actually on access to healthcare. So there is a health infrastructure, of varying quality. So there are hospitals in sort of the major township capitals, and there are some peripheral sites that provide some primary care, but limited. What we found in Chile was a lot of people did come across to India to get their healthcare if they could. There are some community-based organizations that do sort of the backpack health work, which you've heard about, where they'll sort of get their supplies in India or Thailand and come across the border and treat people. MSF is actually active in Chinchay, the Palewa, so they get some health care there. So there is a structure, but functioning, you know, to a limited extent.
Yeah.
I'm curious on the study on the rule of law that you presented. Is that sort of the first of its kind, or are there other studies, and are those corroborated?
I think it's the first of its kind because this is the rule of law is a new measure. They have measured before, like corruption by itself or government power by itself, but not the whole rule of law. So this is the first one.
Yeah, I thought that concept of rule of law was really fascinating. Actually, not unlike human security, brings in a lot of variables and different considerations. A couple questions for you. What countries was...
Can I elaborate on this? Essentially, it is in the comprehensive way you've done it, it is the first study, but there is strong literature that connects governance indicators and the quality of institutions with health outcomes. And this is especially from World Bank data that actually shows very strong linear relationship between infant mortality and some other, perhaps maternal mortality, and governance indicators for a country. But this is the first time that the rule of law was like brought up as a construct with a lot of clearer domains outlined. So this is very important for, I look forward to seeing the data for the region.
Mm-hmm. Quick question for you, Angela. With that, it would seem to me that the countries who had less rule of law, the data might be less accurate or less dependable because of difficulty in accessing people or difficulty speaking about these issues. Has there been any kind of ability to make sure that the data is accurate from a variety of different rule of law indexes countries?
Yes, for sure. I am a consultant for the people that collect the data.
Mm-hmm.
They were here earlier, so they will be able to tell you better about that, but I know a little bit. So they do check, they invite, I think it's a group of 60 people from the country to discuss the data that they collect, to be sure that the data is showing the situation that they are seeing inside the country. This is a probability sample of the population. So, and they take good care of that random selection of the participants. So
it's validated to some extent, at least internally.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was recent, I received a survey of recently in the past few months from the World Justice Project about asking us as health professionals to contribute our opinions of rule of law over the public health and public health laws in the country. I can't recall. So this is supplementary to what you guys are doing.
This is part of the data.
Okay.
What you're answering is part of the data.
Part of the data.
Yeah, they have population poll plus your responses, and they join those two data. And then after that, they discuss with other people from your country.
So you're not only presenting your subject of the research.
Thank you for
just
your help.
Blew the consent.
Yeah, there you go. Anonymity or not. Any other comments or questions from the audience? All right, I just want to close with a round of applause and just really solidifying the important work you're doing. And I know that it takes a lot of courage and challenging the status quo. And I just want to also commend the audience for being here and being present and listening to these important presentations. Thank you.